end of life. And Katie, you mentioned earlier something about hospice. Can you please tell us, what is hospice? What are the advantages of it? What does it provide? And what does it not provide?
Hospice in the United States is a bundle of services paid for by insurance. What it usually provides you is the ability to die at home and have your pain really well controlled. It addresses you as a whole person, not just simply as a bundle of diagnoses that need to be shaped up. So people come to your house, or if you're living in assisted living or anywhere else, they'll come to wherever you are. And probably the number one benefit is really sophisticated pain control and symptom control. I think hospice nurses are probably above and beyond most doctors in those areas. And when your pain's controlled,
above and beyond knowing how
pain management,
how to do it effectively.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because they're really hands-on. They're seeing someone a lot, and they know what's going on.
Yeah. And a lot of people approaching the end of life have pain.
Yes.
So that's number one. But they look at you as a whole person. So they might say, well, what really matters to you?
So there might be a chaplain part of hospice.
Absolutely. Chaplains, social workers, physical therapy, nurse, doctor. All of these people can come to your home as you need it and really help you plan, support your family, make sure the family knows what's going on. And they can be incredibly reassuring for your family about what the end of life is going to look like. I remember when my dad was on hospice in a hospital, a hospice unit within a hospital, I remember the hospice nurse saying, well, this is what's going to happen. You know, his feet are going to turn blue. And his breathing is going to get irregular. And there was something about it that was just so reassuring to know other people have gone through this before. It's not an emergency. This is what it looks like. So they can be amazingly supportive on every dimension, spiritually, emotionally, mediating between family members. My brother and my mother got to have some very meaningful reconciliation that was facilitated by the hospice team right before she died. I think for some reason we've become terrified of hospice for no good reason, as though going on hospice means you're going to die tomorrow. And a lot of times people get kind of dumped on hospice just for the last 3 or 4 days of life, when it's actually a benefit that you can enjoy for at least 6 months, and in some cases for a full year. And my sort of number one would just say, explore it sooner rather than later.
Now tell me, isn't it true that with hospice that you need a couple of doctors to say, well, it looks like the diagnosis is this person has 6 months to live. So there's that to get it on the insurance through Medicare or Medicaid or whatever it is, Medi-Cal in California.
And I think this is one of the huge drawbacks of hospice. This 6 months is an absolutely arbitrary time limit. I think people should be able to be on hospice for 2 years if necessary. If what they want is home-based medical care focused on comfort rather than cure, anybody who's in that position ought to get it. And the idea that you should be able to predict the exact length of time is just actually ridiculous. So that's one of the disadvantages.
Let me just say something about that, because like someone might say, oh, well, if we had all of these people on hospice care, it would just be too expensive. Let's say in Medicare, it would just be way too expensive. Mm-hmm. But what are we saving on the other side of that if we didn't have it and we don't have it now? So what are the things that crop up?
Well, why are we so willing to pay $6,000 for a one-day hospital stay, but we're giving the hospice only $167 to provide services at home for a day?
So this might be somebody had a fall or something where somebody calls 911 and they end up in the ER. for something. Mm-hmm. It just is crazy making, and that's so expensive.
It is crazy making. Dying in an ICU can cost $400,000, $500,000. An ambulance ride can sometimes cost $6,000. So wouldn't it be better to be providing people with home-based care so they don't fall in the first place, or physical therapy at home, or an occupational therapy check of the house to see what the hazards are? Why don't we front-load these minor, less glamorous medical needs and lower the way we reward these crisis-driven, we didn't prepare for it beforehand and now we're in a crisis?
But Katie, we don't have the lobby, mm-hmm. the lobbies in Congress, yeah. and in Washington, D.C. to stand up for these things, because they don't, mm-hmm. they're not part of the economy of some, the GDP or something, you know. I mean, it is a service that's being provided, but mm-hmm. because it's not making a lot of money for investors, so to speak, then it's just,
well,
discounted.
We fund technology, not time. And technology is scalable. Once you invent a pacemaker, you can make basically the same thing and get paid $25,000, $12,000 a device. You can just keep printing money. But if you're paying physical therapists and occupational therapists, you're just paying for time. There's no way to build a lot of profit into that. And so, unfortunately, because we have the powerful lobbies that are really shaping our healthcare system, we are focusing on these high-tech interventions that are profitable and not on the soulful person-to-person work right. that we really need.
So this is information that everybody needs, because we need to have more than 3,000 lobbyists in Washington, D.C. We need 74 million lobbyists in Washington, D.C.
I think it's important. Keep writing your congresspeople. If you don't have, you know, there's not adequate caregiver support in your community or whatever it is, keep writing and putting this on the agenda. Or if you go to those town hall meetings that get held, raise these questions, because this is, it's, you know, they talk about a silver tsunami, which is us upcoming baby boomers as we hit these more vulnerable years. We are going to have to be addressed one way or another. The society is going to need to address it. And I think the more we can get this onto the front burner of our health system and our political system, the better it's going to be. But let me go back. I'd like to talk to you about the disadvantages of hospice.
Please, yes.
One is just simply the difficulty getting on if you're just declining slowly with no super obvious diagnosis. The second is hospice does not provide hands-on bedside care hour by hour. And this is really a shocking surprise to a lot of families. The hospice nurse will come in, she'll provide a very valuable service, but she's going to leave in an hour and a half. And so you need a tribe. You need one dedicated friend or relative who will really be the tent pole for the whole system. And you need a bunch of other people who are willing to step up and drive you somewhere, drop off groceries, wash the sheets, whatever it may be. There's a wonderful book called Share the Care, which has a lovely description of how to divvy up these tasks. One is Share the Care, and the other is lotsofhelpinghands.org.
LOTSA. Helpinghands.org. Lotsa.
Mm-hmm.
Helpinghands.org. Those are two excellent sites.
Yeah. And but, whatever, you know, I think one of the things I learned in the book is you do what works for you. You know, if what works for you is getting everybody together to have one big meeting and talk about it and decide who's doing what, do that. If you're somebody who's really comfortable online, do that.
Yeah, do it. And going back to being at home and actually dying at home. Mm-hmm. There is something that's really, really important that you emphasize in the book. And there at death, two things. One, don't call 9/11. That's a huge, like, blinking red light, you know. And secondly, after death, you need someone to sign off on the death certificate, and you've got to be very careful about that. And those two, I mean, I got to say, because I know people who have run into this and had horror stories. So please tell us about this.
I cannot tell you how many well-educated, including medical people that I know, thought they had everything laid out well. But at the last minute, someone, a caregiver, somebody panicked and called 911. And the result was dying turned from being a natural process into an emergency. Unfortunately, in just about every state except Oregon, if you call 911 and people think it's an emergency, they will revive first and look for your paperwork second.
So even if you have do not resuscitate order, they won't pay attention to that because they're coming in and they're doing the paddles and all the stuff that would intervene in any situation and get the heart and the breathing started again.
Yeah. And
rush them off to ER.
And I've also, there was a case in New York where the woman had been dead for over an hour. And when the paramedics came in, called by the daughter in a panic, called the wrong person, they spent 45 minutes pulling her onto the floor and so-called reviving her dead body. So
I'm beating
sorry.
Her.
Yeah. But I think what's really important is to have some alternatives to calling 911. You know, it's like there's two things. One is have an alternative to calling 911. And the other is if someone does die at home, do not, again, don't call 911 and say that it's an expected death. You need a plan ahead of time because people do panic. Dying is not an emergency. But people haven't seen a lot of death now, and so they do panic. They get scared. So you need a reassuring person you can call. You need maybe a physician house call service if you know someone who's willing to come. You need a visiting nurse service. Anything, any form of reassurance that will reassure the caregivers so they don't call 911.
Okay, we're going to come back to that subject in just one moment. I'm here with Katie Butler. She's the author of The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. She's also the author of Knocking on Heaven's Door, just for your information. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. Mm-hmm. You're listening to New Dimensions. Here with Katie Butler, and she's the author of The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. And we're talking about a home death. And we've covered, like, don't call 911. But if you do call someone, there is certain wording that you need to do. And who would you call? So help us out there.
If someone dies at home without medical supervision, not on hospice, first of all, make a note of the time of death, but do not feel compelled to call anyone immediately. Make sure you say your goodbyes. Make sure you sit with the body if that's what you want to do, or wash and anoint the body. Take a walk with the dog. Wait an hour or two. And then you will need someone to come to the house, a medical person, to sign the certificate noting the hour of death. It could be a nurse. It could be a hospice. It could be a visiting physician service. And if you don't have access to any of those, I suggest you call the business line of the coroner, the medical examiner, and say, this was an expected death. This was an expected death. Those words will reassure everybody in the kind of medical legal community that you need to be spoken, you need to speak to.
Otherwise, they're going to treat it maybe as a homicide. I mean, it becomes a criminal. They have to do a criminal investigation if that's not, if you don't use some precise language.
Exactly. You don't want the sheriff showing up with the sirens blaring, and you don't want the EMTs showing up thinking that they're going to revive the person.
Right.
So if you say this was an expected death, this person had a terminal illness, or this person was 99, and then they can come, and your chances of things going smoothly are way, way, way improved.
So, you know, these are just, and all of this is in the book, so I just want to assure people, hey, you don't have to remember this. This is just sort of jogging you to say, hey, this is a wealth of information that you'll want for your own edification and your family. Mm-hmm. I think that there is one that really kind of pops up for me when, as if we've either had some sort of illness that's debilitating in some way, or aging, just the aging process. Mm-hmm. What is your advice about accepting a new normal?
I feel, again, it's a constant process of discernment, and I turn over and over again to the serenity prayer. You know, grant me the serenity to accept the things I can't change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I think as we proceed into these later stages of life, where so many of our conditions become unfixable, whether it's emotional loss or it's the loss of stamina, or the loss of a friend, we're always going to be navigating this subtle oscillation between acceptance and action. And again, I think this is a reason why I think it's a good idea to have a spiritual practice, is that this process of letting go and accepting things is so important. And part of what it does is it takes us off the hook. We live in this very go-getter, up-by-the-bootstraps society in which if you fail, it's because you didn't think positively enough, or you didn't make enough effort, or you weren't motivated enough. There's a lot of individualistic striving. And the reality is that all of our lives, we face numerous things that are unfixable and that we, by ourselves alone, cannot change. And I think if we have acceptance, we can take ourselves off the hook and not blame ourselves, because we're all getting old. We're all losing our stamina. We all are going to face diseases or chronic illnesses that we didn't ask for. I think it's just very important to stay in touch with the heart and what really matters, the ability to love and receive love. And
what about talking to our loved ones, if it's obvious that they're not going to recover, they're not going to bounce back, mm-hmm. and about really being very upfront about that, and to ask them about mm-hmm. their wishes about dying or whatever. Mm-hmm. What's your advice about that? I mean, I guess it's very individual, but
well, a couple things. One is to not force it on people. it's ideal to do it every year on New Year's Day rather than waiting for a health crisis to do it. And I say start with the shallow end of the pool, which is what gives your life joy? What gives your life meaning? What are your fears? What medical treatments would you not want if you felt you couldn't do the things that make your life worth living? I think sometimes it's just a matter of listening. At some stage, people start saying things like, no more hospitals, or I'm ready for Jesus to take me, and to not shut them down when they say that and say, oh, mom, don't be morbid, but actually explore it. What does that mean to you?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think so, too. I've been privileged to midwife, I'll say, a handful of people, my own mother and two mother-in-laws, my husband. It's not as frightening to actually talk about these things. And I want to just say mm-hmm. something to our listeners about what you've written here and the gift that you've given us, Katie, in this book and The Art of Dying Well. And one of the pieces that is just extraordinary when you talk about making up your medical directive.
Yeah.
There's a way that you give a whole couple of pages of mm-hmm. what you have personally written, that here's what, if I get to this stage, here's what you should do as my proxy in case you're in dementia or coma or something. Here's what I want you to do. If I'm here, here's the quality of life I want. Here's, mm-hmm. and you go through this whole, like, maybe 20, 25 of them, and they are extraordinary. Medical directives. What are they, and why should we do them, and why should we revise them?
Medical directives are a form of self-protection from a medical system that has gone amok and does not always ask you what matters to you and just does things to you. So they are a self-defense mechanism, and we all ought to sign them. However, they've been written in such a medical, legal, dry way that we end up feeling intimidated, and we look at them, we check a few boxes, and we don't even know where to send them, and then we shove them in a file and forget them about them for another year. And this, I mean, 70% of people have not signed them. I would encourage you to see this as an act of deep spiritual maturity and to see it as a sacred act, which is contemplating your own death, which almost every major religion counsels people to do way ahead of any kind of health crisis. And if you can bring that kind of honor and bring your full self to it, you have a better shot at completing it. The problem is these things have been written from the top down. They've been written to address the concerns and anxieties of medical people in emergency rooms and in ICUs, who have a very tough time when somebody comes in and they are supposed to do everything and they know they're causing this person pain. But we need to look at them from the bottom up. And I just encourage you to start with a first draft that's just a personal letter to the person you love who will probably be making these decisions, so that you really put out what your real fears are, what your desires are around all these issues.
So I want to say that for me, I've done a little bit of this. I mm-hmm. now reading the book, I'm going to do more. I mean, and in fact, I do this with a circle of friends.
Yes.
And that's what I'm doing. And I've already written, as I said, our next subject, we need to revisit our end of life care again. We've done it before several times, but I can see it mm-hmm. needs constant revision, and the ideas we get from other people that they might think of something that we haven't thought of.
This is a rite of passage. This is not a checkbox. And if you can regard it as a rite of passage and do it in community and understand the depth and support you need to do this, I think you're going to be way ahead of the game on every front. I'd like to share with you something from my medical directive, the one that I have for if I develop dementia. As a human being who currently has the moral and intellectual capacity to make my own decisions, I want you to know that I care about the emotional, financial, and practical burdens that dementia places on those who love me. So let my wishes guide you. I wish to remove all barriers to a natural, peaceful, and timely death. Please ask my medical team to provide comfort care only. Do not transport me to a hospital. I prefer to die in the place that has become my home. Do not treat my infections with antibiotics. Give me painkillers instead.
So these are a couple of, just a couple of, it goes on for another whole page and a half. And I know that that's going to have people really wanting to read the rest of it, because and that and other things too. Thank you so much. I'm so sorry we ran out of time, but thank you so much, Katie, for being with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Katie Butler, the author of The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. And her website is katiebutler.com, Katie, K-A-T-Y, Butler, B-U-T-L-E-R.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3668.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over four decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org, or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support, and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hello, I'm Brooke Williams, author of Encountering Dragonfly. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about the practice of re-enchanting our world.
CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby, BC. Striving to provide points of view that are rarely expressed in mainstream media.
Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.